Please note that the content aired on this program is intended strictly for entertainment and educational purposes only and does not constitute financial, legal, or professional advice. The opinions, discussions, and views expressed by our contributors, guests, and associated Microwave staff are their own and do not necessarily represent the official stance, strategy, or opinions of the Microwave organization or any of its affiliates. While we strive to provide accurate and up-to-date information, Microwave Radio makes no representation or warranties of any kind expressed or implied about the completeness, accuracy, reliability, suitability, or availability of the content of this show. Any reliance you place on such information is therefore strictly at your own risk. We do not endorse or assume responsibility for the accuracy or reliability of any information offered by third-party websites, linked through the show, or any website or feature linked in any banner or other advertising. We will not be a party to or in any way be responsible for monitoring any transaction between you and any third-party providers of products or services. All audio content of MacroWedge Radio is the intellectual property of the MacroWedge organization, and any use, reproduction, or redistribution of this content without the express written consent of the MacroWedge organization is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to MacroWedge Radio for Friday, June 7th, 2024. This is your host, John Galt. We have a very special show tonight. We're going to delve into an area that doesn't seem to get enough focus, that all of us wish to sit there and learn more about, especially yours truly. And it will become, I think, one of the more interesting programs that we've done, as Alexei Chernobylsky will be joining us in a few minutes. I would like to start the show off just making a few quick observations. The markets were an absolute circus today with Roaring Kitty doing whatever that video program he was, and GameStop losing 40% of its value on the announcement of a secondary for 75 million shares. I'm going to take a little credit tonight, even though I overstated the non-farm payrolls by 27,000. I made a wild prediction of a 60% chance of 67,000 reading. Well, it turns out if you take out the birth-death model, it was a lot lower than that. And it would appear that we're starting to see the games again with the numbers, simply for political purposes, if one delves into the report, which I will over the weekend, and I'm sure many others will also. Also to be considered is what happened to gold today. There are the old gold bugs who have been through every one of these laundromats and disasters that you could imagine. And then there are the newbies, the ones who said, hey, I heard about it on a talk radio show, so I invested in it because XYZ told me it could save my life. Folks, gold took a bath today for one reason and one reason only. The Chinese People's Bank of China announced they're no longer going to be adding to the gold reserves. That should have been enough information for everyone to understand why we had such a dramatic drop, what is occurring with this drop, and why we are not going to sit there and see any kind of bounce to new highs in the short term. Repeat, short term. Long term, brand new story, folks. Long-term gold is in a very good situation unless it breaks severely below 2280, in my opinion. Moving on. There we go. We've got it. Moving on, folks. We have also got to look at the 10s threes, which moved up 15 pips to 95 basis points against the curve. We are expecting this to start reverting back to normalcy, and it has not happened. The 10s 2s also blew out a little bit. We are witnessing the longest inversion in the yield curve in history. And everyone is starting to say, well, it's a flawed model. It's being dismissed. Yet no one is dismissing the Federal Reserve models that they're using for projecting recessions, predicting credit crises, or even worse, inflation. The systems and estimates are all antiquated, and a new mindset has to appear, or we're not going to get out of this dilemma that we witness in our economy. People are thinking that we are not predicting or projecting correctly. We're using old models, old data collection, I should say. If one looks at the NFP, for example, today, 40% is the average response rate from the employers. Think about that, boys and girls. 40%. You're not going to get good survey data. So they're dartboarding it, using the birth-death model to fill it in. And it's not going to have a positive ending for the economy because people are making large financial decisions based strictly on the data that BLS and others are providing for the rest of us. While we wait on Alexi, we'll sit there and bring Mr. Awesome into the conversation. Mr. Awesome, are you there this evening?
Thank you, Spear.
I certainly am. How you doing, John?
Very good, sir. Very good. A quick take while we're waiting on our guests to join us for the data that we've seen this week. It seems to be somewhat disjointed, just my opinion.
Yes. You're talking about employment data?
All of it across the board. It doesn't seem to be any kind of stable reporting for not just the unemployment data, but when you start looking at some of the bank data, we saw a jump in the FDIC warnings about banks this week. We've seen all kinds of new data about foreclosures, yet we're also claiming that we created an absurd amount of jobs when the majority of it was the birth-death model.
Yeah, it's problematic when you look at it in that context. And we've had a lot of different things that we've seen this week, especially today with the employment. That was kind of my biggest takeaway from the week, aside from some of the insanity that happened with GME, but got that if you want. But, we lost full-time jobs. We had fewer part-time jobs net than we had full-time losses, but we wind up with additional 270,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate went up. It's really, I understand everybody's concern when they talk about not being able to trust the numbers. You know, we've had how many weeks in a row we had the exact same number get reported, and we're within the same range. But I think we might start seeing a softer job market moving forward. JOLTS, again, was, way down from where it was, the job openings. They've kind of fallen off a cliff, and with unemployment rising, I think we're just starting to see the beginning of that increasing more.
I tend to agree with you, because I think that the statistical anomaly that you're going to have a less than 1% variation in weekly unemployment claims is absurd. Now, I understand that some people don't qualify for unemployment filings, that it's too low in some areas to even waste the time to apply, but it does seem like a major statistical anomaly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think if you were to run the probabilities of it, they'd be extremely low. I haven't done that, but I can't imagine that statistically speaking, the odds are in favor of it being that consistent. That's kind of a miracle, if you ask me.
Well, what I'm noting also is that we're hearing more and more disturbances in the real estate arena in our region of the country in Florida. And this is outside of what we're going to discuss with our guest tonight. But when you look at what's occurring on the residential side, it does appear that we've hit the peak in prices and a rollover is occurring. And that begs the question, what happens when people jump into a situation with the resets and they have negative equity on their homes? That's going to be a major factor, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's always been a factor. Basically, every recession we've had, majority due to job losses, we have an increase in foreclosures or an increase in stress selling from people that it's the only way that they can extend their ability to pay bills or get by is by selling their home. But you wind up in a situation where you have negative equity, and we've seen that countless times. But now we're talking about a very large difference in what people were paying a couple of years ago versus the cost of capital that was available. So I think you've heard me say it before, there's problems there for a lot of people, especially in Florida markets, in Texas, in certain parts of Arizona, are seeing it right now. And nationally, we have been flat and declining in prices across the board since 2022.
And I find that.
Good.
Go ahead, sir. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I was just saying negative equity is never a good thing never a good problem to have.
110% agree, and I see Alexi has joined us tonight. I think that this is going to be one of those more interesting shows. If you're really into the numbers on limited partnerships, private deal making, and the status of what's happening off the main grid, which you see in the papers every day, this individual is someone that Ulysses Awesome, Mr. Awesome, knows more than I do. I started to catch up on his work. He's got some very interesting points, I think, to bring to the table. And one of the things that I think he's correct on from last February is that we have not hit the proverbial wall. We're in a negotiating wall And it's an ongoing it's going to be an ongoing situation for markets to deal with because let's face reality. What we see in public is only what's being reported by public companies. And I think you'll agree with that, Mr. Awesome. There's not a lot of disclosure on what's happening behind the scenes. And I'd like to welcome Alexi on board. Alexi, welcome to Macro Edge Radio.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
We appreciate this. And I'd like to really begin the show with a question because an article, I see a lot of news feeds and it floats across my desk and I look at it and I think, okay, what are the impacts of this? Fitch Ratings dropped this yesterday. CMBS loan delinquency forecast revised down. Refinance rates to worsen. From what I've read, what I've seen, you're in the middle of this. What is the status of the so-called proverbial refinance wall that everybody's worried about at the end of last year? And where are we at today heading into the second half of 2024, sir?
Yeah, so I guess just to backtrack a little bit, I advise on limited partnerships, so specifically on the equity side, right? So there are people who invest in real estate deals, and some of the folks that are currently invested in such deals come to me for thoughts, and also people that are investing in new transactions. Through that, I see a lot of debt, obviously, since a lot of those syndications were purchased through equity and debt. In terms of what's happening at a high level, I think, I mean, first of all, I would say that the maturity wall news, in my opinion, is quite overblown. I think I'm seeing a lot of loan modifications being done. Some lenders are pretty desperate since I've seen a ton of properties that are not even worth the loan balance, right? And so when the collateral of the lender is not worth the principal that they have outstanding, they start making pretty nice concessions to a general partner who is the equity to a degree that you might not even realize. Happy to, add or go in another direction if people have questions.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, real quick question. So is, Alexi, is the problem we're seeing with the retail properties just being abandoned widespread across the country, is that not even something people wish to speculate or try to refurbish, rehabilitate, et cetera? Or is it just such a specialized area too high risk for LPs and equity investing in that particular area?
Are you talking about office? I just want to make sure I understand what you mean.
No. Retail. The shopping centers. We're seeing empty shopping centers develop all over Florida and grow weeds, and it's spreading across the country as retail has become almost radioactive from what I'm hearing. I'd like to see what you're hearing from your investing perspective, just from the periphery. I don't know if you do any of that directly or not, but more so to sit there and get a picture of where that's at, because that is one of the black eyes that's hitting the commercial real estate market right now.
Yeah, so the reason why I thought you were talking about office is I think there's definitely a lot more challenges there. And retail, I think I would actually directionally disagree. I've been pretty surprised at how quickly some big boxes get leased up. I think if some of the stuff continues, especially, we've seen some bankruptcy news. In a bankruptcy, typically a single tenant will have like a binary right to reject the lease, which obviously, can bring some wrath. But generally, I don't know if I agree with the sentiment. I definitely speak across sort of like the entire U.S. as opposed to that specific market that you mentioned. So, look at like if there is a, 100,000 square foot box in the middle of nowhere and the tenant rejects the lease in a bankruptcy proceeding, like, yeah, you're probably screwed. but like in any decent area, those things are getting leased up. And in some cases, I've even heard them getting higher rents than they were getting previously from the last tenant.
Go ahead, Ulysses.
On that note, I'm curious to see or hear your thoughts on those retail spaces that are leasing quickly. Are you seeing numbers behind that to support that maybe those leases were below market rate, or are there other factors at play?
Many of them are, definitely. A lot of the stuff that goes bad, sometimes the leases were written a long time ago, right? I mean, they were like, let's say, on a 15-year lease. Particularly, this is a case on like sell-leaseback transactions. Some of them are not those transactions, in which case the rents actually might be above market, in which case there's some pain. But then there's obviously a question of capital structure. In other words, can the existing landlord sustain lower rents given the capital structure that they have in place and any reserves that they have?
And for anybody listening out there, sale leaseback, that would be the tenant of the real estate that sells it to a landlord and then rents it back in a way to return their capital from the acquisition. Now, on that, especially in that, because I imagine you're talking a little bit about triple net space, which would be, you know, like a Walgreens or a fast food restaurant. Are you seeing that oftentimes those are separate landlords, or is it two components of one conglomerate that is able to approve the lease modification?
I just want to make sure I understand what you're talking about. Are you talking about the landlords that are leasing to large properties that have credit issues come up?
I guess specifically, I was curious of the freestanding or triple net type of retail you mentioned getting released, or is some of that from the same company, or is it from a different tenants that you're seeing actual tenant replacement?
Oh, I see. Well, so typically, at least sort of like the large release issues that we see are like, you know, pretty public bankruptcies of retailers. And, you know, let's say they have a few hundred stores, right? And so that all of those leases would be included in a bankruptcy proceeding. And then the tenant or its creditors, depending on what's going on, will have the chance to reject or accept those leases. So typically what happens is, you know, let's say out of those 100 locations, I'm going to assume that all of them are single on single site leases, because master leases will sort of play another effect into this. But assuming they're all in single site leases, basically what happens is they will look at their leases and be like, well, I want this one and I want this one. I don't want this one. And then, you know, you'll have like maybe 30 or 50 or something like that they keep, and they exit bankruptcy with a plan, with a new ownership group. Typically, sometimes that's, you know, the old debt, right, that was on the prior business since the equity got wiped out. And, you know, and they'll continue operating in those stores. Now, the remainder of the stores, you know, which can be as much as half in some cases, are going to be vacant. You know, sometimes something is negotiated to get them out. But many times there's not much there. And I mean, you can try to sue, but you know, with bankruptcy protection, you're not usually going to get much, right? And so at that point, you're essentially in a spot where you have to find a new tenant, and you hope that the rent that you can command with that building is the same or higher than you were getting with the prior tenant.
Well, Alexei, I got a quick question. What are you seeing in the office space? You brought that up a moment ago. We're starting to see the idea of office to condo, office to apartment conversions, of course, which happens every time there's a crash. What are you seeing as far as LP and investment in that area? Is it starting to make a comeback and stabilize, or is it strictly a region by region thing?
I think the best I can respond to that is I'm seeing more of it than I think makes sense. In other words, I think the first question that an LP investor should ask when they get such a deal is, have you successfully converted office to residential before? And the vast majority of these deals, the answer is no. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't invest in such a transaction. It just means that the execution risk is higher. Right. And so I'm seeing a decent number of them. I mean, there's like some in Phoenix that got foreclosed on mid project. Like they're just very difficult. They're possible, but difficult. And you really need to know what you're doing in order to get those to work.
Is the potential for that to expand into other areas? And by that, I mean, I know in the older established cities with the older office buildings, it's much more difficult because of the construction of those buildings. But within areas like Florida, where it's extremely difficult due to zoning regulations, the way our zoning is set up in our state, is it feasible to even entertain some of these, or are people overvaluing the real estate before they go into such deals? I'm just curious from that perspective.
Can you repeat the question? I'm not sure I understand.
What I'm saying is, it's the traditional locations where you see the conversions is usually the larger cities like Chicago, New York, et cetera. But in states like Florida, we're starting to see more empty office space also in Arizona, like you said, in Texas, non-traditional states for high-rise office buildings starting to see mass vacancies. But there's difficulty because you're asking to convert not only the building but the zoning for those areas to accommodate that. A lot of that is located in suburbia or in industrial parks, et cetera, office parks. Is it feasible, and are people going into this overvaluing or overestimating the valuation of such a conversion?
Well, so I think the answer has to be yes, right? In other words, if a deck got sent to an LP that got sent to me, it has to be the case that the general partner thinks this is a great deal, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't work so hard to get their promote at the end, right? Unless it's like, I guess, super feed in the beginning. But in many of those cases, the assumptions are pretty rosy, right? And sometimes they're coming from people that have never done this before as well. Like, there's just a ton of challenges and one, as you mentioned, is zoning, but there's a ton of others that, like, you really need to know construction and redevelopment in a, like, a really solid way.
I have a question on that note regarding those in particular or any of the decks that you're seeing. A lot of the development numbers that I've seen over the last couple of years, I have witnessed there's always an escalation of rents over the course of time, but a dearth of people planning for expenses to go up. And I'm curious if you see that as well. You look at more decks than I do, but that's something that's always struck me as very strange and seems like something that people that are generally new in real estate would do. I'm curious for your thoughts and what you're seeing.
Sorry, just to be clear, you're saying you've seen cases where the decks have increasing rents over time, like during the projected period, I'm assuming, but the expenses aren't being adjusted much. Is that what you said?
Correct.
Yeah. In fact, I'm not sure that I've seen many decks that would contradict that statement. I mean, I would say that many decks do have some expense growth built in. But my perspective on rent growth generally, and expense growth to a degree is, you know, you obviously have to do your best to estimate, but all of these estimates are just, I mean, you have no idea what's going to happen right now. I think it's extremely important to understand where the market is today. Like, for example, in some cases I see, you know, I still to this date, I see like, you know, 10% growth in the first year. You know, you look at any market reports for that area and rent growth is actually down 10% against last year. And, you know, obviously you could say, well, they expect it to be up 10% based on the base today. But it's a little hard to justify, I think. And so I think from an LP perspective or really any investor, sensitivity tables go a long way, right? I think you need to make conservative assumptions unless, you know, you have deep conviction with proof behind something, and then you just sensitize away.
That's really good advice, actually.
Well, what are you seeing in the industrial space, Alexi? We're hearing all of the stuff about residential conversions, office space. That's always the flashy stuff that makes the news. From what we're seeing in certain areas of the country, the industrial investing has slowed down, and other areas of the country like Florida is starting to pick up, mainly from specialized ideas, especially transportation, warehousing, and logistics. But with the pullback of Amazon from some of their commitments and other companies starting to downsize their estimates, is there still great interest in LPs, et cetera, investing in such areas?
I think so. I mean, maybe the other question is, do I think that interest is warranted at the levels that I see it? And I think the answer is maybe not, right? I think, you know, people are trying to find great opportunities, and the opportunities exist, but as you said, it's hard to find them. I do see a lot more distress in the multifamily space than I'm seeing in industrial. But I would just caveat with two things. First of all, I think just statistically speaking, that makes a lot of sense, right? Like I advise limited partners, and if you look at all of the dollars that went in to the space, the vast majority of it, I don't have the exact percentage, but the vast majority of it went into multifamily. So it actually makes a ton of sense that, you know, a large majority of the phone calls that I get about distress situations come from multifamily LPs, because that's where the numbers lie, right? Meaning that there's just many more LPs invested in those deals. The second thing I'd say is I've definitely seen some cracks in the industrial space. Like a lot of people kind of bought speculative stuff, and they're realizing that it's very difficult to lease. Some markets have a ton of supply coming. And, you know, I think some employers are pulling back in terms of growth and expanding to other facilities.
That's interesting. Going to the multifamily, and this is an area that we're witnessing in Florida that has exploded, obviously. Have you started seeing condo back to apartment conversions versus the reversal apartment to condo conversions? There's a lot of speculation that the overbuilding of condominiums in Florida is going to result in a reversal of that process at some point in time, simply for the practicality of filling the space. What are you seeing on a national and regional basis? I'm just curious.
I'm not sure if I can comment on that. I don't think I have seen enough data points to have an opinion in terms of those types of conversions. I just haven't seen enough of them.
Yeah, it's been very rare, but I remember the big surge in Florida to convert condo apartments to condominiums in the past, and we saw it again this cycle. And unfortunately, we seem to have an overbuilt condominium market, so I was wondering if you had a feeling if that was occurring yet. Mr. Awesome, you got any questions?
I do. I've actually got one I'm going to field from the readers. JBR wanted to ask, Alexi, your opinion on loan modifications, and will they ultimately impact bank income statements with increased loan loss provisions or reduced net interest income? And then if bank management decides they can't continue with the modifications at the same rate that we're currently seeing, what happens next?
Great question. I mean, so first of all, I'll just say this is a strong opinion, loosely held. I think it would be super valuable to have someone on who has like regulatory experience in the banking world or auditing. But just from my experience, from being in not exactly those rooms, but you know, rooms of public companies with execs with write downs, there's quite a bit of challenges. And I mean, I'll just go into a few things that I'm seeing. So as I mentioned earlier, you essentially have, let's call it a roughly binary situation, right? So either you pushed out a loan and you were excited about the volume to meet, you know, some target for the year to make bonuses. and now you're looking at the loan and, you know, you got a decent appraisal and you understand what's happening and you're like, okay, so the value of the property is at or above the loan if you were to foreclose and or sell in an auction. So in those circumstances, the lenders are not modifying much. And if they are, it's coming with like pretty deep teeth, you know, like such as requiring recourse, like a new personal guarantee or other things. And I think you can understand that, right? Like if the general partner didn't do a great job to date and they can see that, you know, either you dig your teeth deeper to protect your downside, but give them another chance, or you just cut the rope, right? Now, what I'm also seeing, though, is the other side. So, I mean, let's talk about the example where the reality is that the loan, the outstanding or unpaid principal balance on a loan is actually much higher than the value of the property. So in those cases, that's where the modifications are happening, left and right. What you're seeing in some cases is these loans are actually securitized, and maybe I'm just getting into the weeds here at some point, but many times, like in those securitizations, the lender is also the administrative agent, which means it gives them the ability to pull something out of the collateral pool and replace it with something else. And so what you see happening is they are pulling out these troubled loans out of a securitization, but they are forced to put some other assets in, right? Because they have to sort of replace it with something else. But they're replacing it with like, right, but they're replacing it with an unencumbered loan that is much healthier, right? And so the problem occurs is like you can't do that for too long until you have just like a bunch of unencumbered loans on the side that are all troubled. But the benefit, at least in the interim, if they survive, is as soon as you pull something out of a securitization, there's not a lot less public data, right, on that collateral. You don't really have to report on it. It kind of sits quietly, and you just hope no one asks any questions. But yeah, happy to answer more questions if you'd like.
I'm going to take a quick minute here for a commercial interruption. Hope you don't mind, Alexi. First of all, make sure you check out his user ID on X or Twitter, depending on how old you are like me. Very good information coming from there. He has a podcast, lplessons.co, and he also has a Substack. You can view all of that via his link at X, which we'll post up again on macroedge.net and also in the chat. Next up, macroedge.net is still offering a two-week special to sign up for Ozone. Don't forget, folks, go to macroedge.net, get your free two-week trial to see the kind of data that's moving ahead of the rest of the market and the media. I highly advise you go to macroedge.net. Six, I believe you would like to step up to bat and ask a question, sir.
Yeah, I had a couple questions for you, Alexi. So I like to examine like what people in different sectors are thinking. So like I know that you probably look at your real estate investments over a much longer time horizon, LP funds, entries and exits and such. But I wanted to see from your point of view with where interest rates are and where interest rates are projected to be, what you either like, either really like or really hate over the next 6 to 12 months? I know it's a tricky question.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, and I don't know if this is just now, I really don't like the concept of buying something on floating debt. I'm seeing that a decent amount now because people, and I think you can have at least some conviction that at some point there might be cuts. But we've had that conviction for a year and it hasn't happened, right? So I think if you're buying a property, I always advise LPs to think about it as, if it doesn't work with a fixed rate loan, it just might not be a great investment. Otherwise you're taking sort of macroeconomic risk rather than real estate risk, which are obviously connected, but I'm assuming you guys get my point. What I do like, is there's a lot of dislocation, I think. I mean, I've witnessed, deals that have traded well below their loan balance. And that's pretty crazy to see, you know, like those types of dislocations don't often happen. They typically go to, you know, a ready bidder at the right time in all cash. Right. So that's one of the challenges is I think it's very difficult to enter the marketplace, and get phenomenal deals if you don't have those existing relationships, but they're definitely there and they're quietly transacting in a pretty major way.
Okay, great. My next question for you is, as far as the regional banks that are carrying these loans for commercial real estate, there's been a lot of talk about that in the media. What do you make of that? Obviously, the longer rates stay elevated, the worse it's going to be for them. What are you thinking about that? The banks that have a lot of commercial real estate exposure, what level of deterioration do you really see happening? How many of those loans do you think are going to be able to be modified and so forth?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I have a strong opinion here, to be honest. I just don't spend a lot of time looking at public companies or banks in general. I think, I guess my guidance to someone, if in case the guidance is useful, I'm not sure that I'm a subject matter expert in this, but if you are looking at such a book, I think the first thing to look at is trying to understand the collateral value on each of those loans, against the unpaid principal balance, right? In my opinion, and I've said this to many general partners, and many times more to the LP side, I can't predict whether there will be a rate cut or not, or maybe two or whatever. But in my opinion, even if that occurs, I don't think the majority of the pain will go away. When I refer to pain here, I mean a lot more equity than debt, because equity goes first, obviously. The question will be, at what point does debt become impaired? Some of it is already impaired, but that's a much more intricate question, right? It's also dependent on the cost of capital for that same bank, right? Because you could, potentially take over some of these properties, and the one of the interesting things here that I've also noticed, I guess while we're on the topic, is there are like really two types of lenders: ones that are set up to operate such properties, and ones that are not. And so the ones that are not, their decision more or less is auction this thing off. But the ones that are really able to operate and perhaps can operate at a scale that is much better than the existing GP, like those guys are sharks, and I think it's for logical reasons, right? Because they can take over and probably save costs and get themselves into a better position than they are today.
Alexei, I've got to ask. I hate to interrupt your six there real quick. If interest rates, not the Fed funds rate so much, but the 10-year Treasury remains above the 4.5% level for a prolonged period, without any evidence of rate cuts, is that going to become an impairment to making, getting some deals done at much more reasonable cost, considering the valuation on some of the real estate we see out there? Because I think the interest rates are absolutely going to be too high if we stay above 5% plus for a prolonged period.
I mean, everything is relative, right? I mean, I get this question, like, I mean, just to pull you into my world for a second, I get decks all the time, and the first phrase is, you know, we're getting this at a discount to comps, a 10% discount, a 20% discount. And in 9 out of 10 cases, in my opinion, that statement is meaningless, because the question shouldn't be whether you're getting a discount to comps. The question is how much of a discount is fair, given, you know, that the fact that your comps are during a time when people bought and financed at 3%, right? And so everything is relative in that way. So I think if interest rates stay elevated, then I think best case scenario, things stay where they are, or some of this will continue to play out and we'll see deeper discounts.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that. Folks, if you have a question for Alexei, simply request to be a speaker. We'll notice it, approve it, and bring you up into the list, into the line. Joseph is going to join us. Joseph Middleton from the Macro Edge team. Joseph, go ahead, sir.
Hey, I just had a quick question. Also, you were just talking about the collaterals. So over the last, I would say, 10, 11 months, we started to see a lot more collateral devaluations occur. In some cases, mainly it's in the previous office space. But there's always seems to be a component of multifamily or office coming up for a major devaluation, like over 20%. There's been a couple buildings that are dropping for 70% discounts on stuff. And as being on both sides of that, with the securitization of some of these being in the CLOs, how contagious do you think that could be to other areas that maybe aren't struggling, like industrial, if we see these collateral devaluations continue and begin to gain a little more speed into the summer?
First of all, not an expert. This would be like a weak opinion, also loosely held. I'm not sure that the impact is massive. I think where like the big impact is like if you go inside these rooms, right, of banks, there's always a question of, are we deploying more, right? And challenges happen when the answer is no, we're scared, right? So if there's a freeze in credit, and perhaps some of that freeze goes over to industrial, as you said, that's where I think some of the challenges begin.
Right, and that's kind of the point I was trying to get at there. Simply because from a buying perspective, or on someone who's looking to bid for one of these buildings or something like that, I just wonder how much does that spill over if we continue to see one or two sectors continuously lag, like we've been seeing mainly, you know, in it was office starting off, but we had a little bit of retail there for a little while last year. And do you think that's more just a side effect of the excuse me, the times?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I think I don't know enough about this topic. Sorry.
No, that's no problem. It's just something that we see, and we've talked about it plenty of times in our group here and with everyone else at Macro Edge. And it's definitely something that's starting to get attention. So obviously when doing research, it's important to try to look for stuff like that. So I appreciate your opinion, though.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, I think I've stated the soft opinion that I do have. But I think that the system is so much more complex, and I just don't know so much about it.
Gotcha.
Go ahead, Mr. Austin.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. How often are you seeing funds being raised that are just to deploy cash, not to actually involve financing on commercial properties, if at all?
Meaning like an all-cash transaction without any leverage?
Correct.
Like all equity? Pretty rare. It's pretty rare, but I do see it. It's hard to get things to pencil that way, right? The benefit obviously is you have lower risk, but you know, good luck getting to 15% IRR, which is what all the LPs expect to see. Which, you know, I have my own opinions on that part, but
sure,
I'll leave that for the next one.
I'm just genuinely curious because some of what I do on a daily and weekly basis is consulting in the commercial real estate space. And I've actually put together some models lately where cash is returning 15-25%, and it seems like the using cash in real estate is almost unheard of nowadays, from what I've seen in my end of things. But it really is making the difference in a few deals that are actually going on versus not. And I'm even getting other projects that are not penciling because of what rates are. So I was genuinely curious, because you see so many more decks, if you're seeing that that is being used as a tactic, or if it's just kind of by the wayside.
Well, again, it definitely happens, right? And I think there is, it's a very specific type of strategy. And the challenge with it is that you're going to have a harder time raising money, right? It's just much harder to get to high enough returns to entice LPs. Now, I think what many LPs don't do a great job of is considering the risk reward of such a deal against one with leverage, right? Many of them are essentially investing based on IRRs and are not necessarily realizing that there's, you know, some debt to pay in 5 years. And if things change macroeconomically at that point, you know, you might be caught with a cash and refi. Many people didn't even know what cash and refis were.
they learned
until, you know. Yeah, exactly. And I speak to LPs almost once a week where they'll tell me that I thought the worst case here is that I'll get my money back. Sure. And, you know, I for what it's worth, I think such an opinion comes from the residential market, right? Where you have I think everyone understands to some degree that like there are drawdowns and, you know, ups and downs in any market, but I think people confuse residential real estate with commercial, where residential you get a 30-year mortgage and, you know, worst case scenario, unless you just get crushed on rents going down, like you're probably going to come out okay over a long enough period of time. If you wait it out, right? Whereas commercial, like sometimes you don't have a chance to wait it out, right? Like you do a syndication, LPs expect to get their money back in 5 years and your loan matures in year four and things change. And that, I mean, that's what we're going through right now.
Alexi,
you could lose at least in year three, or there's unforeseen circumstances to a lot of these investors is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
On that, John, do you mind if I ask another question? Because I think it ties in nicely with the Bloomberg article that
yeah.
featured Alexi.
That's where I was going to go. You go ahead, then I'm going to go to my next question after that. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Perfect. So on that note, I'm curious because you have a phenomenal quote, and I encourage everybody to go read the article. I posted it below the Spaces link about investors essentially gambling. And I'm curious, I think you maybe answered it, but it sounds like a lot of the investors that are doing that, for people in the trading space, they could probably look at it best through the lens of what's transpired through AMC and GameStop in sort of retail, as you put it, or smaller investors that aren't well educated in the space, investing in a product or something that they don't understand. If you would expound on that for me, that would be awesome.
Well, so I think the quote really talks about gaming, right? And gambling, really, right? And so my point to Bloomberg was, and I mean, I have like very strong opinions about this. I think many people, look, if I take a random LP, right, and you know they call me and they're like, hey, I want to invest $500,000, I want some passive income, and I'm like, all right, let me show you a great GP, and I take them to the casino, and I'm like, surprise, this is the GP. They're gonna be like, what do you mean? Like, are you out of your mind? Like, this is a casino. And they're like, oh, like, trust me, like, you know, it's going to be great. Like, just put some money in and we'll see what happens. So obviously anyone with the right mind will say, well, okay, like, let me give it a try, but I'm not going to put $500,000 in. Like, I'm going to gamble $100 and see how it goes. And, you know, some people might get a little extended. They'll extend their stay and after losing and they'll lose $1,000 or whatever, right? But my point is two things happened. Right. So one is they understand that they're gambling. That's one. And two is they also size their position to something that they can afford to lose. Right. Whereas with real estate syndications, I think many people didn't understand that they were kind of gambling in some of these deals because they couldn't understand the underwriting. Right, like it was just pitched to them as this passive investment, and it's going to be awesome. But it is in many cases, if you look back, I mean, and obviously hindsight is much better than being there at the time. But you look back, and in many cases, the assumptions were outrageous, and they still raised the money, and they raised it in 24 hours, and people weren't careful with how they sized their positions. You know, they double down and triple down, and some of those stories are pretty painful to hear now.
Alexi, I have a question for you just as a quick change. What do you make of the sudden number of hotels? And I'm not talking your average Motel 6. I'm talking major resorts and shells, incompleted hotels and resorts, suddenly going into special servicing, default, and or bankruptcy. This is that considered an opportunity for LPs, or is that one of those radioactive areas where you don't really want to sit there and speculate because it's high risk, high reward, and if the management's incorrect on their assessment of what they can do to refurbish it or bring it back to life, you can get burned pretty easy from what I understand.
It really depends. People hate me saying that, but it really does. In other words, if you brought me a deal and, you know, it was from someone that has done this in the past, and they explained their thesis, and they explained why the basis is so low relative to anything else, and that's the going in basis, right? And then the basis of the property after all the capex and all the things that need to be done is still in a really solid place. So I think that could be pretty compelling. You know, I certainly don't think it's anything you should ignore, right? But if someone shows you the same exact property, but it's from someone that has no experience doing this, and the projections make no sense relative to where comps are today, then it's probably radioactive. You know what I mean?
I think that makes sense.
People really hate me answering this way, but you know, investments are just super complicated. Like you need to assess all the parts and see how they combine and compare and contrast and whatnot. And
so basically, you could say it's basically location and saturation, and then the individuals that are trying to resuscitate or save a property is what you're saying.
Yeah, it just depends on the context around the deck, right? I certainly have seen hotel transactions that were in distress and they looked pretty compelling. And I've seen some hotel transactions that, you know, I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole.
Mr. Austin, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I just think that that's a good way of putting it. There's always opportunities for distress, but there's also always opportunities for good projects, good skills in the space to succeed. So you're probably seeing a mix of that, and I think that's logical. You know, despite some of the things that we look at or view as negatives, it's not all one way or the other. There's problems in the space that in a lot of the spaces that I see, but there's definitely opportunities out there as well.
Yeah, I think there's plenty. Again, as always, I think they're hard to find. But the folks that find it generally don't have such a hard time raising money.
If you were to give a suggestion to anybody in the space right now, what would it be?
On the LP side?
Yes.
I think it's the same advice that I give to everyone. If you don't have time to understand what you're investing in, you shouldn't invest. I think some GPs don't like me saying that, but I really believe in that. If you want passive exposure without thinking, buy an index fund, right? I think an LP investment is inherently pretty complex, and I get calls all the time that are like, hey, I sold something, I have $20 million to invest, where should I put it? And I just tell them you're talking to the wrong person. I think it's super important to understand what you're investing in. And I think part of this also is just the curiosity, right? Like you dig in on these deals and you try to understand them. And I think you have to enjoy that process to make it worthwhile and interesting, because I think many LPs have the sense that they're going to invest in their first deal that they see, and sometimes they actually do, and I think it's a massive mistake. You know, when I was like in the institutional world, I don't know how many deals we looked at for everyone we bought. It's probably 10, 20, in some cases more than 20 probably. And, you know, I don't see why that should be any different with an LP.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I was hoping you would answer that way, because I've heard you say that before about not investing unless you're going to put the time into understanding it. And I think that's good advice no matter what walk of life we're talking about. Putting the time into understanding something.
Yep, exactly.
So Alexi, tell us a little bit about your Substack, your podcast, because people need to learn about this. This has been an educational experience for me. I'm from the logistics, transportation world, supply chain era. You bring a new perspective on LPs and some of the private deals that are happening in the background of finance, because most of us look at the public statements and public deals and public events. What you're bringing to us is something that's a different viewpoint and gives us an opportunity to say, okay, there are opportunities here, but be cautious if you don't know what you're doing. Tell us more about what you're writing about and your podcast, please.
Yeah, I mean, so I advise LPs all day. That's what I do full time, existing LPs and future ones. And I try to summarize some of the things that I see in an anonymous way, to benefit others, whether they are LPs already or looking to learn from other people's mistakes. And, you know, that was the entire reason why I started the Substack, which is lpless.co. I write there, twice a week. And, you know, thankfully it has grown over time. And, part of that is also a podcast where I will anonymously, choose LPs to interview that have something to share. Again, the entire purpose of the Substack is sort of get people to learn from others in an anonymous way. I think there's like a lot of embarrassment, I think, sometimes that goes with this. And so I'm trying to sort of solve for providing the lessons without embarrassing the LP that lost the money, right?
Fascinating. And that's a very noble cause because, believe me, when it comes to losing money, I've been on both sides of the trade. It's very easy to do. And I really appreciate your input tonight and all of the things you've brought to the table. I hope our audience has learned something new. We try to sit there and diversify our guests and present different viewpoints from different areas in the financial arena. Listening to the bubble visions, as I call them, and presenting their usual proclamations doesn't give you an alternative viewpoint. And Alexi, if there's anything else you wish to add to close out the show, please do so, sir, because you have been fantastic.
I really don't think I have anything to add. I appreciate you guys taking the time. Certainly hope this helped people, and I'm pretty available. You know, my DMs are open. Email is alexei@hate.com. And look forward to being in touch with everyone.
Sir, we look forward to having you again, hopefully later on this year, as interest rates and the commercial real estate market plus the election wasteland closes out. That might give us a better picture. If you're available, we would appreciate it.
Yeah, 100%. Let's do it again.
Okay, thank you very much. Everyone,
thank you.
We appreciate him, our guest tonight. We're closing this out at 59 minutes because of X spaces. And I'm just going to go ahead and state this for a fact. We've noticed in our transmissions and our recordings and conversions to MP3 that our friends at X do not have their spaces technology down to a decent level of recording. And unfortunately, it does cause a distortion. So we're going to keep all of our interviews right now within the 1 hour time space. Next week, we hope to have a special guest. We were going to have a second hour tonight. Unfortunately, that could not occur due to some issues. We will hopefully have a special next week. And keep in tune at macroedge.net. And I also post on johngaultfla.com, also at X. All of us do this. When we have new guests, we may have different times to accommodate their schedule. We're more than happy to talk to some of the people that can bring you different perspectives in the financial world. And don't forget, macroedge.net, sign up for 2 weeks of free ozone. It's available. Get it now and get the information and opinions you won't hear anywhere else. For macroedge.radio, this is John Galt speaking, and good night.